This Torah class is brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.
It's truly a privilege to be here from multiple perspectives. Having had the privilege of being involved in Imadi in its infancy, until today being able to see how far it's evolved and how many people it's been able to impact already. The topic of today's talk is developmental psychopathology. It sounds like a whole bunch of fancy words. The reason that I chose to focus on developmental psychopathology is twofold. Number one, given the fact that we are dealing with the outcomes of developmental psychopathology in terms of the families that we are helping. And beyond that, understanding why an organization such as Imadi plays a critical role within the support of a family and what impact that has in general on the trajectory of a family who's struggling and overcoming challenges in regard to mental health issues. It is going to be somewhat theoretical, and for good reason. The more context that we have in approaching all of this, the better off we're going to be able to actually affect change and help them. I know Torah Anytime is here. Thank you very much for recording us and being able to spread this to your viewers, and thank you very much for actually taking the time to watch this. Before we get into developmental psychopathology, we first have to come to a basic understanding of what development is. Now, all of us have conceptions of what development is. However, there's a reason why we have formal definitions. When we're going to be able to look at the multiple components that contribute to the development of psychopathology, we first have to understand what are the forces at play. When we're looking at development, there was always the old question of, is this genetic, is this environmental, nature versus nurture? I can happily report that that debate in the field is long dead. It is no longer a question of nature versus nurture. The question now really comes to a point where we're looking at gene by environment interaction. I had the privilege for 5 years to be at Yale University studying behavioral genetics, particularly looking at complex traits and the development of psychopathology. When we're looking at genetics of any condition, unless it's a very simple single trait genetic disorder, we're looking at a confluence of things. So this definition was offered by Sir Michael Rutter, one of the preeminent authorities. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist, one of the early pioneers in autism research, and a world-renowned behavioral geneticist. So we're looking at interplay. Everything comes down to what is the interplay between all of the variables. So we're looking at psychological, physiogenic, psychogenic. Now again, we're going to define all these terms, don't worry. But it's important that we have a vocabulary that properly captures what it is that we're looking at. Because without being able to appropriately describe it and being able to convey that to others, when there isn't a common vocabulary, things get lost along the way. So we're looking at early experience through... We now understand that development actually continues through the lifespan. There used to be child development classes, adolescent development classes. After that, it pretty much died. There's no longer that phenomenon. Now when we look talking about development, we are talking about lifespan development. Beyond my focus on neuropsychology, my first PhD is actually in development. So this is something that's near and dear to my heart. So when we look at developmental psychopathology, we want to know where pathology comes from. But before we can understand where pathology comes from, we actually have to understand what pathology is. When we're looking at any sort of maladaptive behavior, Now, maladaptive behavior could be at a very minor level. Kid, for example, just misbehaving. To maladaptive behavior being someone who is self-injurious. So the spectrum of maladaptive behavior is extremely wide. But we're trying to understand the individual course. Now we're looking at, there's two different areas of study. We could be looking at this at the individual level, and then we look at this in terms of the much larger scale, in terms of epidemiology and public health. When we are looking at this at an individual level, and we're all here for a reason, what does this have to do with me? Why do we care so much? In order to be able to appropriately intervene, in order to be able to make sure that what it is that you are offering to these families is going to be maximally effective, you have to understand where the fractures lie. You have to understand why is it that having somebody in their life that is going to be able to connect them with appropriate resources, why it is that having a functional outside individual being able to influence them is so very critical. Now, when we're going to be looking at the pathology of this, pretty much this is where we look at how it is that development went wrong. Where did things go awry? Before we can look at where things went awry, we have to really be able to look at how does normative development look like. So before we can look at deviations from normative development, and we're looking at any sort of idiosyncratic development, we have to look at normative development. We have to understand what is considered normal. It's a very hard question to answer. Normal is a social construction. There is no definite understanding that's universally agreed upon that is what constitutes normal. There are differences between social and cultural groups. Differences in when we're looking at cultures, in some ways we'll look at something and say that seems entirely off, but that's really as a result of the individual culture that we're coming from. So it's critical to understand in general, particularly with mental health, that anything that is normative is essentially a social construction. When we are seeing a deviation from normative behavior, that means that within that particular context, what it is that would be considered to be normal is in some way being violated. That is when we are really coming to an understanding something is amiss here. When we're looking at this, so now we have a framework. We're looking at normative behavior, and then we have something that deviates from that. Then we go on to that and we say, where else do we see breakdowns? We see competence and incompetence. Now, we use the term a lot, just colloquially in conversation. But when we're talking about competence, when we're looking at how is that a person is able to lead their life well, how is it that they're able to accomplish what they need to accomplish, what we're essentially looking at is understanding their level of competence. And that competence exists in multiple realms. There's going to be a competence within the workforce. There's going to be a competence with others in terms of their social competence. There's going to be competence in terms of how they run their home. When you're walking into a home and seeing utter chaos, that is an indicator in terms of the level of competence that is going on. Now, sometimes somebody's competence is compromised as a result of external factors. So it is not an internal trait, but it is an outside behavioral manifestation of ability. Then when we're going down the ladder and understanding what makes somebody more vulnerable to developing psychopathology versus others that are far more robust, there's a term that's thrown around. It's very exciting. Resilience. So there's only one problem with that term. The way that it's actually used is wrong. We'll get into the appropriate definition in a minute. The reason why it's so widely used, and it's very hot in education, we're talking about resilience in life, talking about resilience, is because it indicates being able to do something. But the way that we look at resilience is actually, the way we discuss is actually resiliency versus the technical definition of resilience, which we will get to. Risk and protective factors. This is where your role comes into play. The role that you are playing in the family's lives that you are working with is that of a protective factor. You are there to be able to mitigate a number of the existent risk factors. And those risk factors are many. Then we're looking at adversity and privilege. It used to always be thought of that a poor child living in the inner city is the child that's really going to be most predisposed to developing mental illness. Every social ill that exists, we look at poor access to healthcare, poor neighborhoods, not sufficient fresh food supply, schools, that's what we're looking at. But what's more poorly understood is when we're looking at it from the privilege perspective. There is an entire phenomenon that is now being studied in terms of what are the negative effects of affluence. I had the privilege of studying with Dr. Sunil Luther, who is a preeminent authority in developmental psychopathology, and for the last 40 years has studied the risks of affluence. I can tell you just from my private practice, in terms of what we see, the level of risk that a child walking in with coming from a background of affluence, and we're talking about significant affluence, we've seen whoever's names are plastered on buildings and names are on every Chesed organization, we have them in our files also. And I explain to the parents, it's great that you're able to provide this to your child, but what you don't understand is what you have also done is negatively impacted them. And it's not always the case. There are some very affluent people who manage it well. Then you have affluent people who it dictates their life, their child's ability to deal with any level of adversity, their ability to overcome anything, and the uncomfortable conversation of having this conversation with somebody who is a major philanthropist in the Jewish world, telling him, buddy, your money ain't going to buy you healthy kids. They don't take that too well for some reason. But it is a conversation that I've had to have numerous, numerous times. And then we're looking at, when we're looking at adaptive functioning and maladaptive. So adaptive functioning is being able to overcome things, functioning well within the appropriate context. And then when we're looking at when their behavior deviates from that, and when their the general mode of operation deviates from that, we're looking at a maladaptive pattern. Now again, maladaption is a very broad term. It doesn't necessarily have specific connotations beyond something is wrong here. And then we look at coping and crumbling. How well can they deal? To understand that better, we're going to get into more specific detail, but at this point, any questions? Easy enough. Thank you. As a clinician, oftentimes a parent walks in under the guise of wanting clinical intervention, but what they're really looking for is Nevi'is. And if we all had Nevi'is, my job would be so much easier. But what we do have is we understand clinical trajectories. We understand what we have seen before, how weird's gotten people, what have been the positive and negative effects of it, but it's not a science. It's not a perfect science because the constellation of variables that are at play are too great to be able to have a level of control that you can properly predict. So we can look at risk factors, and we can look at the constellation of risk factors, and we can have a general sense as to where these things may end up, but it is not definite in any way. And that's where really understanding protective and risk factors come into play. So we do it. We have to do it. You know, one of the most common questions we'll get about it, is this person fit for marriage? Which obviously has very real implications in terms of answers. You're dealing with a couple. One of them has a particular pathology, or both of them have a particular pathology. And then you're supposed to be able to predict an outcome. I was sitting with a couple late last night, and very newly married couple, and the task that I was given was to be able to predict, is this marriage going to be able to last? Is this husband going to be a functional member of society? Is this wife going to be able to deal with this? Now again, don't have the crystal ball. But when I'm looking at all the diagnostic features of each of them, and then looking at the combination between them, and looking at life circumstances, that is what we're really trying to figure out. So again, it's probabilistic, it is not deterministic. And then we, in terms of interventionists, which I am not one of, we're trying to find the critical point where a level of intervention can change the trajectory. We want to be able to try to manage the undesirable outcomes. We want to be able to come to a point where if we know how this develops, and if we know how we have to intervene to get a different outcome, that is where therapy and intervention comes into play. But we can only understand the role of therapy, the role of intervention, once you actually understand what we're up against. If we don't have sufficient appreciation of what it is that we're contending with, we're never going to be able to appropriately respond. So, in terms of some of the work that I do, I don't do therapy, I don't do treatment, I only do diagnostics and assessment. Because you can have a clinician treating and treating and treating, but without knowing what it is that they're treating, you're not going to get very good outcomes. So when we're trying to understand how do we intervene at a level that we're going to get a different outcome than would be the natural trajectory, that's when understanding each of the influencing processes become most critical. So when we're going to offer a framework for all of this and really be able to look at this, we have to look at human development in general as a learning process. And when we're looking at development, even particularly normative development, we're looking at certain developmental tasks. We're looking at areas that there's a expected trajectory. We have a general sense of what should be happening well and when and exactly how those come about. So we're looking at human development. We're looking at skill acquisition. That is the objective. When a person is appropriately developing, they are gaining new skill. Now, the second a child is born, they are pre-programmed immediately to start trying to understand their environment. The interaction between their environment is actually their first level of learning that exists. When we're talking about in the field in general, how it is that children develop and what are the influences involved, there are major schools of thought, but one of the more predominant ones, particularly that are used now more in education, is that of constructivism, out of the work of Jean Piaget, where he understood a child coming to develop, a child coming to interact with the world, is really how they learn. Their learning is only through that interaction with the environment. And that starts to begin immediately. So where does psychopathology come into play? Where does this developmental breakdown come in? That's when faulty learning happens. That's when how things should have been happening doesn't happen. And that there's many, many factors that can influence that. So when we're looking at faulty learning, we're looking at a developmental failure in many ways. And that developmental failure has cascading effects. They're far broader in implication than we can understand. So when we're looking at a developmental task, we're looking at what should this person be able to do at this particular time, and how is it they should be able to respond. This is what we're referring to. Now again, we are pre-programmed genetically to want to learn. Now that learning has to be taking place within a context, and that context is whatever the environment is that the child is brought into. So early childhood adversity, when we're seeing significant risk factors early on, that's when we become most concerned. This whole concept of early intervention, which Baruch Hashem and Lakewood is knocking, that came out of the work of Yuri Bronfenbrenner, one of the preeminent developmental psychologists out of Cornell. Because what he understood is if I can change a child's life early on, if I can give them, quote unquote, the head start that they truly need, I can start to neutralize some of these negative factors. I can give this child a greater chance at success. And he was actually the one that argued for the Head Start program and got it passed. That's where this is all coming from. So we're and the learning that we're talking about is not textbook learning. We're talking about how it is that a child learns to navigate their environment, learns to understand the world around them, learns how to respond appropriately, all of that. The concept behind, particularly cognitive behavioral therapy, is an instructive approach. It's educational in nature because you are trying to reteach something that was originally learned in a faulty manner. Of what? Faulty learning? Let's go very early on. Let's look at a level of mistrust. How it is that somebody learns to trust somebody else, right? So as we have a tremendous amount of literature looking at even infancy. There's famous studies called Ghosts in the Nursery, looking at literally children that were in the nursery, how it is that their level of development and attachment forms. So if a child's parent, let's say, is inconsistent, and they don't necessarily always meet the needs of their child, and the child learns that they can't depend on that adult, what ends up forming is an attachment style that's disorganized at best and can get much more negative from there. So when we're looking at learning, so to say, the initial learning is that you can rely on others. There are people that are here that are safe. All of a sudden, if I'm even very, very early on exposed to that not being the case, the conception of others that I start to build is not a healthy one. When I learn that the only way to get my way is I have to be punching and kicking because that is the way that my environment responds best to me, that is what I learn. Now again, some punching and kicking is entirely normal and developmentally appropriate. When it's beyond that point, I've now engaged in faulty learning that's going to have to be reprogrammed. So again, any developmental task that we're looking at, when initial faulty learning takes place, it then has to be overcome by further levels of intervention. When we're looking at this general framework of developmental psychopathology, it's really pulling from a lot of different places. Obviously, the basics in terms of child and adolescent psychiatry, both typical development in terms of what we call developmental psychology and then abnormal psychology. There's a tremendous amount of work in the cross-cultural research world because of understanding if norms are socially dependent and culturally dependent, being able to study specific cultures and the outcomes that they have within those cultures and being able to extract from them variables that we've seen either positively or negatively affect outcomes is something that's is a tremendous area of study. Epidemiology is essentially the statistics of how often things occur within the larger public, looking at public health data. Then we get into, you know, more recently neuroscience and genetics, which are the two most rapidly moving areas in science in general. So when we're looking within this framework, we're looking at there's two different forces here. And there's two different kinds of research that we're looking at. There's translational research, which is very hot. Now all the hospitals have an office of translational research. And the concept behind that is you take something from bench to bedside. Meaning you have basic research going on in a laboratory, but it's not just done for the sake of research. There's direct clinical implications that are going to be able to be implemented. And then there's this transactional model where there's this constant give and take between them. And when we're looking at how dynamic development truly is, we have to understand that we're going to be looking at both the transactional model and then the translational model as well. Sometimes we will see somebody change. We will see someone be able to take intervention and incorporate that. But the ability to change and how sustainable that change is and the extent of that change is really going to be dependent on the on how deeply it is that it is integrated, and if that particular skill is targeted, elicits plasticity. Now again, plasticity we want. There's a concept called neuroplasticity. Everyone's very excited about it. Most people know little about it, including those that talk about it. Anyone who's done real traumatic brain work, when you do traumatic brain injury work, you actually understand neuroplasticity. Now it's a very hot thing we use in education. We're cool because we can talk about neuroplasticity. But when we're looking at plasticity, it means change that's happened and is sustained. It's able to stay on. And then we have a level of elasticity that it means initially there's a response, then things bounce back. It doesn't stick for very long. When we're looking at that, the gains are very short term. They're not sustained, and real change doesn't come about. And then when we're looking at adaption, again, we're looking at positive adaption, means that they're going to be meeting those necessary developmental tasks. And then we have maladaption, when things go wrong. And when we are looking actually at the gene by environment interaction, what we are now understanding more is that it is actually transactional in nature. It goes both ways. When we are looking at, there's an entire field called epigenetics. Epigenetics is the way that the environment impacts actual gene expression. So it always was thought that whatever's encoded in the genes is going to happen regardless. Now we understand, and again, the research in terms of early maternal stress, all of those areas, we looked at it in rat puppies, it's a very robust literature by this point, is understanding how environmental factors actually impact gene expression. And when we're looking at that, we have to understand that there are specific genotypes, specific genetic characteristics that are going to be impacted by different environments differently. And when we are looking at, excuse me, and when we're looking at how the environment impacts this particular genetic profile, what we're actually understanding is the level of sensitivity that that particular gene profile has. Because there are some of them that are very robust and are not particularly sensitive to environmental changes. Whereas others are much more sensitive to the environmental exposure. Now again, we're talking about here complex traits. We're not talking about single. So again, within genetics, there are multiple levels of genetics, how we do the studies, and we're talking about, in terms of complex genetics, looking at multiple factors here. This is one of the most important things that you can possibly walk away from today with. There's an understanding of two people starting off with the same risk factors and ending up in very different places. And that's what we call multifinality. And then there's the concept of people starting off with a different set of risk factors and from a very different place and ending up in the same place, which we call equifinality. The difference in a person's outcome, understanding that if a person gets intervention at a certain point, that even if they're starting off with the same exact risk factors, that level of interjection as a result can change what the outcomes are, is exactly why we are looking at a multifinality. We want to be able to say, yes, these are the risk factors, but because there were intervening variables that took place, that was able to change where this was going. It's critical. Now, even within families, if we're looking at it from an environmental and genetic standpoint, you will have siblings that grew up under the same exact conditions, share 99.9% of this genetic material, and yet outcomes can be vastly different. Now, most of that is environmental factors outside of the home, and then again, some of that genetic variation that exists.
What are the differences? Is that genetic or is that
Well, and mostly environmental.
So you have two people, the same family, same general genetic, and intervention causes different outcomes.
No. Intervention is not causing different outcomes. There naturally will be different outcomes. Intervention is trying to cause a positive outcome. But even though you're starting at the same place, the same pathology, can intervention cause a different outcome? Yeah.
You can never really start at the same place.
In terms of?
Even two fetuses.
Again, but if we're in terms of. Correct. But when we're looking at. We can only control for so much, right? So when we're looking at the general framework, again, even twins are not. But when we're looking at the general framework of looking at environmental factors, looking at genetic factors, they're as close as you can get in terms of similar environments. All of the genetic research early on were all on twin studies, right? Why? Because you could only manipulate one of the variables. Here, we're being able to look at, given the fact that they share so much of the experiences, yes, it's not going to be perfect. No one lives in a laboratory. But outside of the laboratory, this is pretty much as close as we can get in terms of looking at it. But again, understanding that intervention can bring about different outcomes, regardless of the fact that they're starting in the same place. And when we're looking at transactional influences, that means I am being influenced by my environment and by particular factors, and then I, in turn, also influence them. And when we're looking at this, we can look at this in two different ways. We can look at this in terms of the individual and look at all of that, or we can look at it in terms of the factor itself and how the factor works across multiple areas. Also a term that's thrown around a lot and poorly understood is a risk factor. When we're talking about risk factors, there's a huge gradation in between the level of risk that each of the factors can carry. So we have something that can be a very minor risk factor, and then we can have something that is a very substantial risk factor. So what we're really looking at is what is the increase in probability of a negative outcome. As a result of this existent risk factor, if this continues without intervention, what are you going to be looking at? And then we have protective factors, things that are able to intervene, things that are going to be able to help reduce the risk and therefore change the outcome. Everybody in this room here, by definition, is a protective factor. The role that you are serving is that of protective factors. You are trying to change the trajectory, being able to put a protective factor in as opposed to allowing continual risk factors to be at play. When it is that we're looking at risk and resilience, again, we still don't have an appropriate definition, we'll get there. But what we want to be able to do is figure out where a person is going. What is the likelihood that they're going to go along a successful path versus one that's going to have significant issues? And if we're going to understand adaptive and maladaptive behavior, if we're going to be able to understand how we get to this place, without understanding this risk and resilience, we're never going to get there. Because otherwise, we're just looking at it as just happenstance. If it's just happenstance, we can't intervene. We have no means of changing the outcomes. And when we're able to really understand that everything, a person sits within a constellation of factors. Those factors are both protective factors and risk factors. And it's really the balance between those risk factors and protective factors that are going to impact long-term outcomes. And once we're able to better identify and understand risk factors, we can do intervention. We can do prevention even, because that's when we can understand, if I get onto this now, before it gets out of control, if I can change this variable now, I can have a different outcome. That's really what the core of intervention is all about. And within each risk, we're going to be assessing that person's profile against that risk and how strong of a risk factor it truly is. Because they could have personality traits that counterbalance to a great extent risk factors. So let's go back to this couple I was discussing last night. The woman's greatest risk factor is she's far too nice. She's allowed herself to be far too vulnerable. So given it, now again, if she would have presented with entirely different profile, and my sense would have been, okay, there's a level of robustness that's going to be able to in some way counterbalance some of the things that are going on, I would be looking at a very different outcome. But here we have a profile. We're looking at, given the proclivities of this person, how are they going to be able to deal with this risk? How are they going to be able to overcome it, or is the risk going to overcome them? That is when we're understanding characteristics and profile of the person and what it is that outside of that can be done. So we're looking at risk in direct relation to that person. And when we are looking at that, we're going to understand that there's not going to be single factors that are going to get us to a certain outcome. What we're really looking at is cumulative risk. Whenever we're looking, both in terms of genetic studies and in terms of environmental studies, we're not looking at single variables, because single variables don't tell the whole story. What we are looking at is really when they co-occur, multiple factors, to what extent are we going to get a specific outcome given to a person or within a specific population. So there's entire statistical modeling that we use to be able to calculate what the actual cumulative risk is. Now, that level of cumulative risk is only relevant when there's a certain level of vulnerability. When the vulnerability doesn't exist, and it doesn't allow, again, everybody has a vulnerability, but within that particular domain, they're not predisposed to vulnerability, that level of robustness to great extent can ameliorate the detrimental effects of those possible outcomes. Back to my pet peeve, resiliency versus resilience. In order to have resilience, there are two preconditions. Number one, there was exposure to significant adversity. And number two, the response to that adversity was in fact adaptive. People are trying to teach resiliency. There is no way to teach resilience, because it is it's a byproduct of somebody being able to overcome something that they have been presented with. So we use it to capture a phenomenon, but in terms of the actual definition, you first need to have that adversity, and then you have to have positive adaptation in face of that issue. What we want, we cannot always manage risk factors. We actually do a pretty poor job of managing risk factors. What we want to do is be able to help look at protective factors to then allow a person, when they are faced with significant adversity, to respond adaptively. And once that's occurred, what we're actually looking at is resilience. Yeah.
Are you going to be able to take some of our situations and put it into play?
Present the situation.
Give an example of resilience experience. Like in the EMA-D contracts, you know, for our volunteers.
I much rather do real life. Pick one. The rest of this was theoretical. Now you can talk tachlis.
No, a situation that a family is going through, and then where this resiliency is
and where we based on their reaction to adversity, how they react.
But where does our role?
You're being a protective factor, right? So, pick a case, play it out.
I'm not going to change into so many details, and I feel uncomfortable.
Okay.
Can I offer?
Please.
A teenage girl living in a home with a tremendous amount of strife, and she is unable to get therapy because the parents are denying that there's any problem. problem, but she's living with that cognitive dissonance that there's, she's internally crumbling, doesn't have anyone, any parental figure to validate what she's going through. She's being told that she should be happy and that she should be appreciated her life and everything.
So whatever we're looking at dysfunction, where's her functional breakdown? Where are we seeing the breakdown in her, forget her emotional experience, functionally where are we seeing a breakdown?
She feels like she's living, that she's coming home from school every day to a prison. She's living in a prison and
that's feeling
okay.
So function, where are we seeing a break?
Anxiety, depression.
And what is that anxiety and
despair?
Okay, what is that depression and anxiety? Where is that manifesting? Where are you seeing it?
It's how does it play out?
Is it affecting? So again, so let's take that for example. No, I'm just saying in terms of understanding. So again, in terms of defining pathology, we need there to be a functional impairment. There needs to be something that we're seeing.
I mean, she's still able to act academically.
So that's exactly where I was going.
So when you talk about like,
so she should really, given her adversity, she should be unable to get up in the morning. She should be unable to go to school and engage in any way appropriately. She should not be able to keep up any sort of facade. She should have already been dropped out of school and refusing to leave her room.
Absolutely not at all. She's actually thriving from that. If you describe that, I would say that she's thriving with all of this. Okay.
So that is a case of resilience. She's faced with significant adversity and she's responding to it adaptively as a result of it not negatively impacting her academically or socially. That is a resilience.
I have a question on that. One can be apparently confident and acting super resilient on the outside. These are my cases. And then they're cutting or they're eating disorder.
So
resilience is quick. But
again, by definition, that's not an adaptive response.
Right.
So the definite, when we're looking at an external variable, but if we're looking about if it is adaptive. So anyone who's cutting, by definition, that's a maladaptive response, so they're not resilient.
You can be resilient in different areas, in terms of work, in terms of a
relationship. You can function, but you can't be resilient.
Okay, so that's the difference. Function does not mean resilience.
Correct. And resiliency does not mean resilience. So the fact that someone is being called, is being driven to cut, maladaptive response. Can they be functioning in other areas? Yes. Yeah.
Is when somebody asks how can we functionally be a protective element in a dysfunctional environment? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
So I'll state an example. I'll just paint a condition of a mom who does not get up repeatedly for days, weeks, does not engage with her children, cannot function with her children, sends them to neighbors, friends, abandons them, is not having a functional marriage, sometimes resorts to physical violence, mild, not enough that I would call authorities, but like hitting or being inappropriate. What's my role? Until now, what I've done is just support, empathy, validation, encouragement, you know, guiding towards assistance. I cannot go and organize this organization. I can't go organize.
Right.
I cannot spend physical time. I cannot over-engage because I'm already over-engaged. She's asking what would be the best position I can take to be an adaptive.
You're being a protector, but again, but your involvement by definition is a protective factor. Without you, the situation would have only so what you are demonstrating is you're being a protective factor. Now, where you can make maximal.
I don't see giant leaps in function in her life. Or many leaps in function.
Halavai, in direct intervention, we would see giant leaps in function.
Therapists don't either see it
okay.
And what you're really dealing with is a far larger systemic dysfunction. You're not talking about a single variable, a single factor. You're talking about systemic dysfunction.
Possibly misdiagnosed.
That makes it all the more fun.
Misdiagnosis. Yeah, it's a lot of it.
Yeah. Misdiagnosis are
one, just a layperson, so
one of our favorite things. No, but even that. So let's look at even misdiagnosis is a massive risk factor.
Huge. Especially when someone's on medication.
Both in terms of intervention, both in terms of their own perception of themselves, their level of efficacy. If I have that condition, by definition, I am this, and therefore I am precluded from doing whatever it is that that is. So in terms of, so misdiagnosis in and of itself is a tremendous risk factor.
And as a volunteer, my place is no more than to ask, have you ever gotten a second opinion?
Correct.
That might be a nice idea, and if the husband's opposed, shut up.
When you need to, but when there's room to be able to strongly encourage, and again, husband being opposed, and you have to understand where within all, and how much of the pathology he's offering to this wonderful picture, and how much of his pushing back has gotten them to this point to date, are all factors that need to be considered.
This is a functional relationship between an EMD volunteer.
Correct.
And
That's doing, again, moving her towards getting help that she needs.
Maintaining medication protocol.
That in and of itself is a massive victory. Yeah.
Resiliency
is the general trait that everyone talks about and feels warm and fuzzy about. When resilience has this very specific connotation of adaptive function in face of significant adversity. When we are looking at different levels of adaption, when we're really looking at it holistically, we really need to understand that we take this all for granted. The fact that a human being is able to respond at all, given your case, for example, that she hasn't gone into hibernation and she's going to school and functioning, is exactly the strength of a human that we are trying to capitalize on. And it is not something that should be taken for granted, because if we take any other organism and put them in those stresses, they're not going to function like this.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
Challenge?
Very good question. The answer is, first of all, she has very few options. She has to just survive at this point. And the answer is, in order for her to have a functional marriage, she's going to have to work through much of her experience to get her to a point where her soul level of engagement with human beings is at that level. And what gets really scary is when they don't get their intervention and they find a spouse that is perfectly well suited to elicit those responses, that's when we get fireworks. But really, in terms of understanding what are the risk factors, why has this been her response? And people, it becomes very much part of who they are. It becomes very much part of, I can't say core personality, but at least in terms of their operating personality, and it can become a very prominent part of it. That can sort of be their signature. And a lot of that is all about self-protection. Because if for a moment I am not in that mode, I am immediately vulnerable. In a moment I'm not like that, my environment is going to overtake me. So that response that she's having, as in some ways being maladaptive, is exactly what's allowing her to get up in the morning and go, because I could tell my environment, I'm going to do what I want on my terms in the way that I want to, as opposed to doing what it would be natural in terms of response to such adversity.
Some level.
Again, it's all about degree and extent. So you can have an adaptive response. Again, in the cutting situation, even though you're functional, your response is not adaptive. But if you're able to channel your energies into something positive, if you're able to do things that are still functional, again, does it mean there's going to be no impact on the person whatsoever? No. But their overall response to the adversity is adaptive, then we have resilience.
They will pay for that at a certain time.
Again, there's always that balance. It's a dynamic system. Again, it's going to impact you. Again, the extent. Have I crumbled as a result of it, or am I coping? Am I able to keep up with what I need to be doing, or is this taking over my life? That's what it comes down to. When we're looking at historical systems of how we've understood this, and we've studied it within specific cultures, we look, again, what are cultural variables that help? One of the primary protective factors is communal belonging. I think being in this building, within this setting, within this town, speaks volumes as to, within specific cultures, what it is that those around them can do in terms of having resources, having that level of support that's crucial in every one of these things. And at the same time, specific cultures, including our own, offer risk factors. So again, none of it...
We have risk factors.
Only protective factors. And we have very real risk factors that are not unique to Lakewood, and some are unique to Lakewood, but we have beyond that in terms of our general communal expectations, we have specific risk factors as well, and we'll get into some of them in a minute. When somebody is experiencing all of this, when we're looking at this contextual risk factor, right? So we spoke here about, let's not trash Lakewood for a minute, but let's looking at children who grow up in severe poverty. Limited access. Now, once there's that level of poverty, there's limited access to many things. Healthcare being one of them. We also look at other risk factors. One of the primary risk factors is level of maternal intelligence. Yeah. Why? It can be the greatest protective factor, and it could be the greatest risk factor. The more capable the mom is, better outcomes kids have.
Emotional or intellectual?
Intellectual. We're not talking
about intuition. So parenting is
right. If you want
five. Five what?
Five,
no such thing as five intelligence. Don't believe what they say. Shh, doesn't have all. We'll get into intelligence. It's a whole different story. And now they're adding an adversity score to the SATs.
So, Dad, do you believe emotional and intellectual?
As an intelligence or as capacities?
No.
I believe you could have greater emotional capacity and understanding. The fact that Peter Salovey came up with an EQ equation, it's an ability, it's a capacity, it's not a smartness. Intelligence is intelligence. I'm a stickler on this because this is a primary area of interest of mine in terms of understanding. I do the development of intelligence. Not IQ. We use a faulty measure to capture cognitive ability through IQ. IQ testing is one of the most flawed things that exists. We're getting a capture of a socially constructed small sample of behavior and making real life implications based on that. But again, not. I would say emotional capacity. Look at the outcomes. And being able to navigate life, being able to get the help people need. maternal age. Very, very clear literature in terms of how that affects it. So now we're looking at right away when I'm doing an eval on regard. I'm gonna get in trouble in either direction here. When I'm doing an eval, even on a geriatric population, I'm going to go back all the way to pregnancy, labor, and delivery. Now, obviously, they don't remember that. But if it was traumatic enough, mom made sure to lay on that guilt, and they've heard the story. Invariably, we have to know from the beginning, where is this all coming from? Was there a hospitalization? What level? These are all factors when we're understanding how did we get to this point. Without going into that, we're not capturing the whole picture. Individual differences. So we talked about intelligence for a moment. Executive functioning skills, also a term that everybody likes to talk about. The part of the brain that mediates executive function is the prefrontal cortex. It's part of the brain that develops last. White matter tracts from the front of the brain to the back of the brain are being developed till age 25. Much of what... I always tell parents, you just have to survive long enough to see it. Much of what Imadi offers in terms of external support is taking the role of an external executor in terms of being able to impact function. When we have families and clients that we're working with that are engaged in poor decision making, they're have difficulty organizing. They don't know how to prioritize. They don't know how to make good decisions. What we are looking at, and to a great extent, again, some of it's standalone executive function, some of it's secondary to more severe mental illness, but what it is that we are looking for is really being able to help that. Self-regulation skills. When somebody becomes dysregulated, all bets are off. One of the most important skills that everyone in this room needs to have is first manage yourself before you can try to manage or help others. And it's far harder than any of us would like to believe, because we are unfortunately only human, and we also react to things. But when your own management isn't appropriate, and you're not at a point where you are truly regulated internally, you are very, very likely not going to be able to impact the other person as well, merely as a result of your own dysregulation. Now, in terms of relationships with other adults and peers, this is a hallmark of what Imadi does. Now, again, we're not talking about it's being buddy-buddy. We're talking about having a peer, having an adult that you can connect with, that you can have a relationship with, and be able to then move them forward in whatever it is that they are struggling with. And then community resources and opportunity. Good schools. Lots to be spoken about here. Just let's deal with numbers. The last estimate that I heard this week is right now there are 37,000 school-aged children in Lakewood. Let's do analysis. 30% of students in schools have a diagnosable learning disability.
Has that always been that way?
Always been that way. And that's not Lakewood specific. That's, we have somehow different learning. Let me just do the number.
10,000 something.
Okay.
I said add something. My calculator.
So look at early risk factor. Child suffering and struggling significantly through school. Child walking around with learning disability. Child walking around with self-concept that is negative. You have to survive many years of school before you can get beyond that. Mrs. Trapper is here, who is a phenomenal advocate for the students who get appropriate assessments done that allow then for intervention to take place. But when we're looking at that, and we're looking at protective factors, one of those protective factors early on is getting the necessary intervention as early as possible, because their school experience will have long-term effects as to how they perceive themselves. Again, if somebody feels like they're a failure earlier on in school, right? You got to survive school, but it's very hard to survive as a good student. So what I have to do, I start engaging in maladaptive behaviors. Once those maladaptive behaviors are there, it's very hard to rein in. And again, look at every school structure as an individual environment that has its own risk and protective factors. So this year, it was a great teacher. Last year was a miserable Rebbe. How are we doing this? And those are all contextual variables that you can't control, but directly impacted. Invariably, when I'm doing an assessment, I will get to hear, oh, you go through the grades, this one was great, this one was terrible, this one was so uptight, no one could breathe in the classroom, this one yelled the whole, one after the next, after the next. And again, that's all environmental factors that are being interacted with the child's own personality and cognitive ability. So we wanted to talk about risk factors, that some may exist in Lakewood, some may not. Let's look at overall. So we're looking at developmental complications. Mother with little education. Looking at anything genetic. And looking at parental psychopathology. I can tell you that oftentimes I get much more from a 5-minute intake from the parents then I can get in a full evaluation from the child, because this is not about the kid. From the initial phone call, and how many phone calls, and how frequent those phone calls are, and what hour of the day those phone calls took place, to were they on time for the appointment? How many times did they knock on the door before they were ready for their appointment? What do they come with? How prepared were they? Do they know what's coming? These are all factors. From the time they walk from my waiting room into my office, I already have to have an operating assumption. Because without that, I'm not giving the kid a fair chance. I'm not in their homes. I can only look at the samples of behavior that I'm privy to. And when I see immediately this is how they're handling, this is what their MO looks like, I oftentimes will think to myself, what chance does this kid stand? This is not about the child. This is about how we can mitigate the risk that growing up in a home with these as your parents exists. And we can't control that. But again, having the level of intervention, being able to put something in place that can mitigate some of that in and of itself is invaluable. Prolonged separation from parents, which oftentimes happens when you have a medically fragile child. Birth of a younger sibling within 2 years. This is developmental literature. We're not talking about communal norms. This is well documented in terms of being a developmental risk factor. Childhood illnesses. Obviously, then you have what happens when a parent is physically not well, and then what happens when you have a parent who's mentally not well. Sibling with a handicap. Again, these are looking at all of the different factors that are going on. Family discourse. The amount of time in my office that I have to end up managing Shalom bias. We're sitting in an office, you're here to talk about your kid, and it ends up becoming a Shalom bias session. Now, I don't like doing Shalom bias work. This is why the reason I don't do it. But in order to be able to help the child, understanding those dynamics, understanding what it is that this child's experience on a daily basis allows me to gain insight into their experience. And you would think, like, everyone's on the best behavior, you come to that, you're trying to, like, everything has to look perfect. Within moments, it all unravels. Father being absent, any sort of loss of job. When we're looking at loss of job, we're looking at obviously a level of economic instability and high level of stress. Change of school, people move. And then we're looking at divorce, which is a very, very real risk factor. And then death of a sibling. We're looking at what are things that are structurally risks to the family unit. And then we have protective factors. Being from the firstborn, being good-natured, easily responsive, independent, they know how to help themselves, they have good communication skills, focus and attention and control impulses. On the way in this morning, I was on a phone call with a Rosh Yeshiva about a shidduch. The question came up, the boy disclosed he has some sort of learning issues, ADHD, and parents ran to the Rav. The Rav said, you have to have a clinician call his clinician and figure out the extent of it. So the mom calls me up and says, what am I supposed to be asking here? Why is this, like, so he has ADHD, like, why lots of people have ADHD? Why are we concerned over here? This is where we're talking about as a risk factor. We're not talking about somebody whose overall function is good. We're talking about when the impulse control, their ability to regulate themselves, their ability to maintain what it is that they need to be able to do, their ability to wake up in the morning, have a schedule, be a bala chrayis. That's what we're looking at. We're not talking about garden variety ADHD, where they're generally okay. Internal locus of control. Children who do not feel a sense of agency, a sense of independence, a sense that they have a level of control over their world, struggle significantly. First of all, every problem that arises is yenim. It's always them. It has nothing to do with me. It's always, if that would have been different, my response would have been different. It has nothing to do with what they've done. They're always looking, there's always a teretz, there's always an answer as to why it is. And once I do not have an appropriate sense of agency, I don't believe I can affect change in the same way either. And I'll see it in young children, I'll see it for sure in adolescents, and I see it in young adults as well. When you don't believe that you are your own entity, and you don't believe that you can actually do something to change where this is all going, you're in big trouble. And again, we'll have it in academics, but we'll have it behaviorally. We'll have, name the domain, having a sense of agency, believing that you can do something to change something, is a hugely powerful thing. Sure.
I may not be related, but very spoiled children, very affluent spoiled children, may be missing some of this. They don't take responsibility for themselves.
I have a case going on. The name brand Gvir. Bachar in Yeshiva. Balkishrin. His father thinks much larger than he is, but the Balkishrin comes in and back and forth. And I'm sitting there, the two of them are bickering. You both are children. Both of you. You've only enabled the next generation, but we know who your father is. We know exactly how it got here. So I told the father straight. I said, this is your doing. This is not... The fact that now, in middle age, you've figured out that you have to be your own human being and do something with your life, and I was like, why is that? You brought this on. This had nothing to do with him. This is how you lived until this point. So when he's 45 years old, maybe he'll also wake up. Huge. And we see it time and time and time again. It comes with the stories that we can tell in terms of how the Gvirim try to get in, and who and what, and push and pull. And there's
doing the same thing that they're accusing the
children of. Even to get the appointment for the child for the same issue. Because it's a given. I'm going to do what I want to do. There's no rules for me. It only exists for Yana. So when we're looking at protective factors, when we're looking at environments that are helpful, we're looking at obviously a good parent-child relationship, having other significant adults in their life that they have relationships with, structures and rules in households. When you see a kid walking in from a house that's in ganzen Hefker, there are no rules, nothing matters, everyone does as they please, you're not getting very far. I saw a case yesterday where the parents fully acknowledged and they walked in with a tremendous amount of Jewish guilt. Our child got to this point only because we have no expectations of him. It's all good. Baruch Hashem, it's Parnasa, everything is good. There's shalom bayis. But expectations on the kid? Zero. And now they're waking up that maybe that wasn't the best mahalach. And they're beating themselves up about it. But this is the environment your child grew up in already. Yeah, you can implement some things, but and the second, when they try to respond differently, all of a sudden, now they're depriving their child. Now all of a sudden, why are you being a tyrant? Why are you micromanaging me? So that shift after the initial exposure and understanding of what that child's life is, now all of a sudden, they have to try to remake that. Very, very difficult to do in Pullman. When we're looking at just for globally, war and terrorism, which if we look at, let's say, Eretz Yisrael for a moment, the level of persistent, widespread PTSD that is now being treated. Israel is now at the forefront of PTSD research because their entire population walks around with it. Dangerous neighborhoods, poor health care. When we're talking about poor acculturation, when we have, again, there's a general culture that we have, and then we have other elements of culture that when they are interjected to the more general culture and they do not acculturate appropriately, being able to really get into what it means to be whatever, even within a school environment. Every school has a specific culture. A child, for whatever reason, who cannot adapt and acculturate appropriately is always going to feel like they're not in it. They don't belong. Once somebody does not have a sense of membership, once someone does not belong to something, there's nothing holding them. And this is particularly true when you have a child who's coming from a dysfunctional home. I have nothing at home to hold me. I don't really feel like I belong to anything at school. Where does that leave that child? There is nothing holding them. These are the kids that are the scariest, because they have nothing to lose in the world. Those are the kids that have the greatest risk factors, because you cannot look at a single social element within their life and be able to say they can rely on that.
How do you view Israel? So would you probably define globally, everyone would say the resiliency or resilient, and how does that match up with your peers?
Well, they've had to have a level of resilience as a result of the adversity that they face. Again, in terms of their economic growth, in terms of what they've been willing to do, when there's been analysis on it, they're all risk takers. They say, "Hey, we got nothing to lose."
So they can affect both ways.
100%. So we're looking at good, and then we're looking at a community where we have good things. There's sufficient economic stability. We have supportive social networks, good neighborhoods, access to good health care, decent parenting, and a feeling of attachment and belonging. And the final trump card is luck. There's a Rebbe Sheinikel that I work with, and the mother always says, without protexia, the kid would have never been born. We always need that protexia. We always need the element of luck. And because again, it's not a perfect science in terms of predicting outcomes, but having, Itaka has luck, not necessarily, if we look at luck from a statistical standpoint, it's a variable that we can't control for. It's not a variable that can be easily quantified in any way or controlled in any way. What? Malam and Amaza. The screen is being... Okay, so now we're looking at two different levels of outcomes. There are proximal outcomes and there are distal outcomes. Proximal outcomes are those that you're going to see very quickly. You're going to see right away. So issues in terms of learning and attention, being very negative in terms of it's all my fault, feeling like they can't do what they need to be doing, poor impulse control, poor moral development, a lack of interpersonal skills. These are all things that we could see rather quickly. Depression, PTSD, any sort of phobias. Everyone's busy with separation anxiety. When we're looking at separation anxiety and we're looking at it from a true scientific standpoint, the level of attachment initially and the strength of that is where we're going to really see how well people can actually separate from their parents. And then we get into truly maladaptive behaviors in terms of things such as substance abuse. Long-term outcomes, the more distal outcomes, is elements that are going to be somewhat incorporated in personality. So we're going to be looking at how they deal with their level of fear, how they view the part of cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, is looking at the attribution, where it is, whose fault is what it is. You're looking at it through multiple lenses. You're trying to change the way that people attribute things. Looking at how well they do both academically and occupationally. Where do they want to go in life? You meet somebody, you have a conversation with them, and they have no idea what they want to be doing. They have no direction because all they've done to date is try to survive. And when they've only tried to survive, there's no room for them to actually think about next steps. And then you get into all sorts of long-term developmental issues and difficulties in treatment. So, to conclude, risk and resilience are qualities that are specific traits that need conditions such as significant adversity and a positive adaptive response. When you have resilience, when you're able to overcome that adversity, the lifespan trajectory of that person can be altered. We're really looking at the constant interaction between genes and environment, not single direction. In order to fully understand all of this, we need further research. And understanding that environment directly impacts genetics is really where the field has moved. And understanding how at every possible developmental stage there are different factors that are going to be at play and how it is that those are going to interact with other factors are going to constantly be areas that need further development and understanding. If we're going to sum up everything and we're going to look at what is development, it's dynamic. It exists within a context. It is the organism within that context that is developing. It unfolds. There's a natural unfolding process that is determined genetically, and the time that that development is taking place, as well as the environment that is taking place in, is critical. By definition, we're looking for a level of stability. At the same time, there needs to be a level of change. Having an understanding of developmental psychopathology as a whole is being able to have an integrated perspective and understanding how it is that psychopathology exists across the lifespan. Questions? Questions?
So could you please take 3-4 minutes and tie this into our volunteer roles at EMD, saying, given this information and that information, your role is that?
So, if it was only that easy of an equation. I think...
But in general, how can we take all this information and bring it into
the most direct answer to that is understanding where the major risk factors lie, understanding where your intervention is going to make the greatest impact is really what you want to be focusing on. Understanding, these are all constellation of variables. These are not single variables here. Being able to understand that, understand why things are the way they are, and as a result of understanding that, where your role and within the resources that you have to offer, where you can leverage those to get maximal outcome.
Thank you.
Questions?
That was fascinating.
Good. Whole semester worth.
You've just experienced another Torah class brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.